The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hello, and welcome to the Lawfare Podcast. I'm Benjamin Wittes. On October 25th, the Hoover Institution held a media colloquium for a diverse group of distinguished journalists at its headquarters at Stanford University. The day-long program involved presentations by people associated with Hoover's Task Force on National Security and Law, of which I and several other Lawfare editors are members. The event was not open to the public, but the sessions were terrific, and Hoover recorded them and made the audio files available to Lawfare to podcast. Most of the journalists involved, moreover, consented to having their remarks made public. So over the next few weeks, we will podcast several of the sessions, beginning with the first presentation of the day, my own discussion of Ken and My Book on the Obama Administration's National Security Law Speeches. The book is called Speaking the Law, and is being published in serial form by Hoover. The first three chapters are all available on the Speaking the Law page on Lawfare. Both because the sessions were long and because not all of the reporters agreed to have their remarks used, I have edited the Q&A portion of this discussion.
Thanks to Hoover for putting together this really amazing event. Thanks to you all for coming. So I want to leave as much time for you to guide the conversation as I can. So I'm gonna speak briefly and try to give. There is no way in 20 minutes to give a real overview of all the material that Ken and I have treated in this project, and I'm not gonna try. Actually, I'm gonna focus on a few aspects of it that I think are sort of particularly salient right now. I sort of incorporate by reference the rest, and I'm happy to talk about any aspects of the material that you guys were given that you all want to talk about. I want to do three things, and I'll try to cram it into 20 minutes. First of all, I'll just tell you a little bit about where this project comes from, because it is a sort of an eccentric little project, and it's different from anything else that I and Ken have ever done, either together or individually. And I actually think there are some sort of substantive implications of the sort of story behind the project. Second thing I want to do is talk a little bit about speeches as a way of delivering law, which is a kind of an unconventional or seems like a sort of an unconventional thing for the administration to do, to basically deliver itself of very substantial doctrinal statements in the form of documents that begin, "Oh, thanks for having me at the, you know, blank college of, you know, whatever." And then finally, I want to talk about one aspect of the president's, or two aspects really, of the president's May 23rd speech at the National Defense University that deal with, on the one side, the end of the conflict, and on the other hand, certain targeting questions as pertains to the end of the conflict, how the announcement that we are moving toward the end of the conflict, assuming you take that seriously, affects the law of targeting and some of the devices that the administration has built into that speech in order to bridge that time frame. So let me start with the project. This is a very eccentric little endeavor. Ken and I, which has a sort of an eccentric history, that it is a credit to Hoover that when Ken and I sat around this table a couple years ago and said, hey, we want to do sort of a real-time book on speeches that whenever a new one happens, will tear up whatever we've done in the past and kind of reintegrate. And so it'll be both sort of a resource in real time, but also at the end of the day, a book and a reference. The reaction to that was not to roll eyes, but actually to take it seriously and do it. Project started at the very beginning of the Obama administration when I was editing a book that several people in this room contributed to. And I asked Ken to do a paper for it, and he told me he was interested in writing about targeted killings, which is a subject that, by the way, nobody was talking about at the time. And Ken had an instinct that this was a sort of important area to think about in late 2008, early 2009. I guess it was more in 2008, actually. And I kind of ran with it. Now, Ken, one thing you guys might not know about Ken is he's not the promptest person in the world. And so he got me, and he also tends to write long. He got me very late an incredibly long document about targeted killings in the Obama administration, which had, I think it's fair to say, I was sort of shocked by it when I first read it, because it read to me like he was basically, you know, outflanking John Yoo way from the right, was the way I described it to him at the time. But basically, the piece argued that, A, the Obama administration, which was then incoming, needed to take very seriously the need to defend the practice of targeted killing if it was going to be able to use it, that there was a significant chance that this was going to become the Guantanamo of the Obama administration, and that the only way to do this was to defend it aggressively in public. And number four, and here is the most what seemed at the time to me faintly outlandish, part of it was that the only way to do it was to defend it not merely with reference to the AUMF, which was, for those of us who were at the time steeped in, detention policy, which seemed really the high salient matter at the time. The AUMF was kind of the Bible for us. And Ken made this argument that actually the AUMF was a dated instrument. And we had to think about what the mechanism for overseas targeting when we were going to do it was going to be beyond the AUMF. Now, all of this today sounds like the Obama administration, and it doesn't sound especially outlandish. At the time that he articulated it, and it was really quite far out as a set of propositions about what we should be thinking about. And we published the paper, and over the course of the next few years, the administration began giving speeches in which they did basically that, exactly what he had been talking about, in more or less the language that he had described. And so I think, you know, I had some fun at Ken's expense, but, the truth is that it's very rare as a scholar that you get You see the mechanism and the substance through which that mechanism is going to address policy as clearly as he did in this paper. And the result of this was that he and I were both fascinated by this set of speeches when they started being given, and I think followed them with a sense that this was something consequential that required a sort of a doctrinal examination. I want to say a few words about speeches as a mechanism of delivering doctrine. We have this prejudice against them because they're not OLC memos. They're not legal briefs. They're not a lot of things that we think of as the way administrations talk about law. As a historical matter, speeches are actually a very common way for administrations to talk about law, and specifically to talk about, you know, opinio iuris of a country. But they're kind of out as a, the Monroe Doctrine, I think, was delivered as a message to Congress, which is sort of the early 19th century equivalent of a speech, right? I mean, the idea that presidents sort of say what they think about law in the form of speeches. Some of the famous Lincoln documents that we think of as having major legal implications are speeches or messages to Congress. But it's not a form that we have used in an active sort of way in recent years. And the result is that it has a kind of a disreputable quality when a group of administration officials get up and don't release the underlying materials, but do characterize them at some sort of high level of altitude in a sort of assertive capacity. Here's our position. No, we won't give you the underlying materials that justify it adequately. So our observation was that partly because the speeches themselves are sort of, as a form, not regarded as real law, people actually don't read them carefully enough. And particularly, people don't read them carefully enough with reference to one another. That is, if you take, I think there have been 14 or 15 major speeches now that we treat in the book. If you take them as a, you know, line them up and treat them in a non-temporal fashion as almost, as a set of policy statements and legal statements that the administration has made, they've actually put a huge amount of material on the table. But we almost never do that. We almost never say, all right, take the sum total of everything the administration has said. So the purpose of this project was really to do two things. One was to try to identify how much information and the nature of it across the range of issues that we debate in overseas counterterrorism or domestic counterterrorism, for that matter, what has the administration said, and to try to create the cohesive document out of this material, as cohesive a document as you can. And then the second was to try to evaluate the framework to the extent that there was to the extent that there are things that one has to say either in defense of or in critique of this framework. What are the areas that they've done well? What are the areas that they've done badly? And what are the areas that are substantially underdeveloped and sort of still need further articulation? The document that we all gave you is the sort of first part of that. The second and third, we released the third chapter, I guess, yesterday morning. The second chapter is a sort of attempt to evaluate the framework. And the third is a sense, is a chapter specifically about the president's May 23rd speech at the National Defense University, and sort of an effort to examine what he said in relation to the prior framework that these speeches had articulated. And that's actually what I want to spend the balance of my time talking about. So if you look at the first term speeches as a group, as is reflected in chapter one, there is a cohesive vision of the conflict. And that vision, broadly speaking, is that A, there is a conflict that is cognizable under international law as a non-international armed conflict. B, that invokes certain war powers, including the powers of, you know, targeting the enemy with lethal force. Also with respect to the power to detain the enemy when captured. And third, that is non-geographic in nature, and that while there may be sovereignty or policy constraints on your ability to target the enemy, basically you are operating in an environment of at-will targeting, at least as a matter of law. And the administration had previously adopted a significant, particularly in Brennan's Harvard speech in 2011, significant policy restraints on the use of that targeting. But the legal environment is an environment of at-will targeting. If you're a member of the enemy, if you're part of enemy forces, you are legally subject to being targeted. The president's speech in May proposed substantial changes to that. And some of them operate at the level of policy, and some of them operate at least aspirationally at the level of law. And I think they raise very profound questions going forward, which I will just sketch out here. So what did the president do in this area? He actually did a lot of other things in this speech. But what he did in this area is, A, he described and insisted on the idea that the conflict is not endless, and that announced a intention of bringing the conflict to an end. Now, the end of the conflict is a very dicey concept here, because one of the other things that he did was he vigorously defended his efforts to target the enemy with lethal force, which is something that's pretty hard to do, or much harder to do, in the context of a conflict that's no longer taking place. And so the challenge of balancing those two and integrating those two themes is a very, very difficult proposition for the administration. And I think reflected in that speech is a matter of some personal anxiety for the president, though I wouldn't presume to speak for his, you know, emotional state. The speech has, in my opinion, a remarkably clever device for reconciling this problem. And the question is whether it's too clever by half. So let me sketch it out. If you're going to bring the conflict to an end, in the context of a conflict, an armed conflict, you can target the enemy under pretty liberal rules. We can talk specifically about what those rules are if you want. In the context of a of no armed conflict, the rules are much, much, much more difficult, which is to say, you know, you're operating in presumably a standard of extraterritorial law enforcement, presumptively. And if you're going to target somebody with lethal force, it has to be under standards that would satisfy self-defense, which is to say, you know, some significant imminent threat that justifies the use of lethal force. So what the president did, so if you think about going from an environment in which there is a conflict to an environment in which there's no conflict, you basically have three distinct stages. One is, or maybe they're not so distinct, but three stages. One is an environment in which you're still operating under the AUMF, as in now. One is an environment in which you're in some sort of transitional phase. Maybe there are no longer troops in Afghanistan. Maybe you're in parts of the world in which you don't want to continue to assert the viability of the AUMF, the vitality of the AUMF, but you still claim AUMF authorities in other contexts. And then one is your genuine post-AUMF authority, right? What authority to use lethal force postdates the AUMF? And if you can think about these as graduating levels of tightness in whatever targeting rules you're going to have. So what the president did is he articulated a single set of targeting rules, which he announced now, going forward, under the AUMF, that I think it's fair to say, if you take them at face value, would be lawful under all three of these periods of time. Which is to say, you, as a discretionary matter, tighten the rules of targeting under the AUMF such that when you are no longer under the AUMF, those same rules would continue to make your operations lawful. Now, so what are the rules that enable you to do this? And I feel a little bit silly talking about Anwar al-Awlaki when Scott Shane is sitting here, but the answer is you export the rules for the al-Awlaki killing to non-citizens, plus one, actually. So the al-Awlaki rule was that, you know, the administration claimed the authority to target a U.S. citizen when it was at least for a senior operational leader of al-Qaeda, when he poses an imminent threat, when his targeting is consistent with the laws of war, and when his capture is not feasible. Now, the first and third of those are the relevant ones for this, for purposes of this. You take the standard of imminence, and you take the standard of non-feasibility of capture, and you add to it what, I forget the exact language that the president used, but near zero possibility of civilian casualties. And you have a standard that presumably could survive scrutiny under human rights law, not in the context of an armed conflict. And you apply those rules now, and then you don't have to change them as the conflict ends. So this is a really, really clever strategy intellectually, in my opinion. It has a certain philosophical and theoretical elegance. And the question is, I think, twofold. One is it practical? You know, can the administration actually restrict itself to drone strikes in situations of near zero possibility of civilian casualties? Or is that another way of saying, you know, we won't do drone strikes anymore, and we're sort of curtailing targeting entirely? Is that too restrictive a rule for them actually to live with, is question number one. Question number two, and this is a possible way to resolve question number one, these, if you adopt these rules, does it put pressure on the words imminent and the word feasible that is so extreme that the words cease to mean what people understand them to mean? Now, there's some evidence. So the word imminent in U.S. targeting law is already the subject of, you know, shall we say, significant dispute. The U.S. has used imminence for many years as a, in a fashion that is not, you know, quite its dictionary definition in temporal terms, and we can talk about that if you want. But I think for present purposes, the more significant question may be the pressure on the word feasible with respect to capture. And if you restrict strikes to situations in which capture is not feasible, and you take the word feasible at its dictionary level, and you add to it a near zero possibility of civilian casualties, you're simply not going to be doing a lot of drone strikes. So the question there, and I think the verdict yet is out on it, and I'm going to stop here, is whether feasible will really mean something more like convenient, and whether we're going to operate in a world in which what we call feasible is really an account of whether there would be likely negative consequences of doing it one way versus another. And imminent, which already has, you know, significantly shifted in meaning, really means last certain available opportunity. And so I'm going to stop there. There's a lot beyond what I've just talked about that may be of interest in the sort of framework paper that you guys have, and I'm happy to talk about any of it.
That will go ahead and open it up to questions. Greg, and then we'll come up to Scott.
I wonder, Ben, what you think of how much flexibility they could preserve in this word imminence. We saw this case earlier this year where there was threat reporting indicating potential plots against U.S. facilities in Yemen and elsewhere, followed by a flurry of strikes. And then sort of things die back down. So you've sort of set out this kind of teeter-totter with terms on ends of this pivot, and how might an administration go forward and preserve the flexibility to ramp up when it's worried about and bring things back down?
So it's an excellent question. There is a great difficulty with the word imminence, which is that international law kind of requires that you use it. And B, it doesn't describe what we're trying to do. And so the reason imminence is important in international law, and it actually has some lesser importance in domestic law that I think is probably easier to get around. But the importance of it in international law is that, you know, you're not allowed to use force against an unconsenting country or on the territory of an unconsenting country as a general matter
unless you can invoke self-defense as a justification for that. And self-defense, the general rule when self-defense can be used preemptively is tied to the imminence of the threat emanating from that you're trying to repel. And so the challenge is if you don't use the word imminent, you run into big international law problems that, you know, the United States really doesn't want to run into. On the other hand, on the other side of the equation, the idea of imminence is not quite what we're doing. And this has been a problem for, you know, it's not limited to the Obama administration. It's actually quite old. But there are these situations, and terrorism presents them very acutely, where you don't really know how imminent the threat is. What you know is that somebody is working on something awful, and you have an opportunity now to strike at it and to end it. And you don't know that you will not, that you will have another opportunity. So I think that the non-terrorism sort of domestic analog to this is think about a hostage situation in which I'm holding all of you guys hostage and there are these windows around the building that there are snipers who have sights in through. And I'm moving around the room, fading in and out of the sight range of some of these snipers. I'm not holding a gun to anybody's head, but I'm, in general, endangering everybody, and you don't know when I'm going to snap and start shooting people. I think that's a sort of a good example and a good sort of like non-terrorism analog to what we're talking about here. And the question of whether you construe that as an imminent threat to the hostages or whether you construe it, as Brennan described it in one of his speeches, as a continuing and serious threat, threat is almost a definitional question. But here's the challenge from the administration's point of view. You want to build as much flexibility in as you can. But the more flexibility you build into the word imminent, the less it sounds like actual imminence. And then the more it sounds like, you know, out there and serious and we have to take seriously, which is not either the traditional international law standard for invoking self-defense or the traditional executive legislative at the domestic constitutional level. The president has inherent authority to repel imminent threats. Not so clear that he has inherent authority, absent congressional approval, to repel continuing serious threats. And so, look, you can make imminence do a lot of work. But the more work you make it do, the more controversial your position is going to be. And I think they are struggling with that. And their answer has been, and I don't know that there's another real alternative to this, their answer has been to talk about imminence in a fashion that is non-temporal. You know, when you say non-temporal imminence, the average English major is going to give you a funny look, right? That is, you know, relatively candid that they don't know how imminent some of these things are. And over time, I don't purport to know, to be honest, whether they're going to resolve this on the side of flexibility or whether they're going to resolve it on the side of, you know, not offending the most people. And I think a lot of that will depend on threat assessments. And I do think it produces a very substantial constraint on their ability to declare the end of the conflict. That, you know, as long as you haven't declared the end of the conflict, imminence is a policy consideration. The moment you say you are not operating under the AUMF anymore, imminence is now a legal requirement. And I think that among other considerations, and the fate of Guantanamo detainees is another one, operate as a very strong constraint on the president's ability to say, okay, the AUMF is done.
Scott.
Isn't one of the problems with speeches as a way of presenting policy like this, is that, I mean, my impression is that maybe they don't take it that seriously, and because it's sort of a political, has a political goal as well as sort of an explanatory goal. So with this crowd in particular, if anyone has noticed dramatic new transparency about targeted killing since the May speech promised it, I would love to hear the examples. And this the same thing sort of, well, I remember when Brennan gave one of his speeches, he laid out a lot of criteria, and then I think it was a Japanese reporter said, can you talk about signature strikes and how this applies to signature strikes? And he said, I'm not talking about signature strikes if there are such things. So he had just given a whole description of targeted killing and then turned out to only apply to part of targeted killing. And even the, you said that this is going to really constrain them now that they have, now they've laid these things out. But as Greg points out, in August, there was this flurry of strikes where you can certainly have the sense that they sort of, threw out the rule book and said, you know what, this is a really serious threat. We're just going to blast away. And the near zero standard, the administration says, was put in place, the near zero chance of civilian casualties was put in place right after, a few months after they came into office. So it's always been there. That's supposedly not a change. But, we've all read and written about cases where it didn't work out so well. So I just wonder if you could say something about whether speeches are sort of a little too squishy, really, to kind of lay out this kind of...
Right. So there's actually, three issues in there. One point of clarification. I did not mean to say, and I don't think I did say, that this will constrain them in a what I mean to say is that either this will constrain them in a very substantial way, or they will have to make the words imminent and feasible do an enormous amount of work. And which of those, which of those is likely to happen is your guess is as good as mine. On the higher altitude point about speeches. Speeches have advantages and disadvantages over other ways of articulating law. You've identified some of the disadvantages. And look, these speeches are many things other than forums for articulating law. One of them is politics. And, when we had to edit the speeches to remove all the stuff that isn't relevant to the articulation of doctrine, sometimes you remove almost the whole speech. and there's a lot of other stuff going on in these speeches, including, in some cases, intra-administration rivalries playing out in public, including, in some cases, people feeling left behind by the fact that other people have been giving prominent speeches and getting a lot of press for them, right? So there's a lot of reasons why, the Senate-confirmed layer, gets an invite and says, yes, I'm going to make a speech. That said, there is no doubt that sometimes they have gotten well out ahead of their ability to deliver. Secrecy is a very prominent example. Closing Guantanamo is another very prominent example, which they still insist on talking about as though it's something that they're really going to do. So there is, administrations have fantasies and self-image fantasies, and speeches do, among other things, provide a forum for the articulation and propagation of those fantasies. That said, speeches also have certain advantages over other forms of articulating law. And one of them is that they are interagency vetted. We have a kind of fetish that we make about legal briefs as reflecting the articulated positions of the United States. But when the government submits a legal brief in some of these cases, that's just, you know, the civil division of the Justice Department saying what it needs to say to win a particular case. The speeches, and there's actually a really excellent, I say this phrase very rarely, a really excellent law review article that's worth looking at by a woman named Rebecca Ingber, it's an article about decision, events that catalyze decisions in the executive branch. And one of them is when you need to, when litigation forces you to file a document, that has one way of catalyzing a decision in the executive branch. But another is somebody gives a speech and has to articulate policy, right? And those do tend to be much more interagency vetted. They tend to have more, this can work both ways, right? It can either be everything gets removed because that's how you get to the least common denominator that can articulate, but it can also really force the administration to say, hey, what can we really say here? And provide and create that sort of synthetic, synthetic position that really represents the administration. So there are some areas where your point is well taken. There's some aspects of these speeches that you shouldn't take all that seriously, and I think secrecy is an area where, you know, frankly, you shouldn't take the Obama administration that seriously, right? It talks a much better game than it has ever delivered. On the other hand, my view is, hey, this is the vehicle by which they have articulated law. And if you're serious about understanding what they have put out there and what their views are, there's more in this material than in everything else, except in discrete areas. I mean, you know, in Guantanamo, they have the habeas litigation to articulate their positions, right? But in certain areas, particularly related to the nature of the conflict and related to targeting, this is where the game is.
Steve was up next.
I'm wondering what the state of the law was before the war on terror, before 9/11 or maybe even before the troubles with Al-Qaeda in the 90s. What would we have considered sort of the outer limit of what we're entitled to do or what the president is entitled to do with respect to non-state actors in unconsenting countries? Are there any useful historical parallels, or is this all basically a new problem?
So there are useful parallels, and they're not even parallels. The problem, the specific problem of when you can target Al-Qaeda with lethal force did not begin on September 11th, right? There were strikes that took place before that, Tomahawk cruise missile strikes in Afghanistan and Sudan, that had to be authorized as a legal matter. And they were authorized in the absence, in the Clinton administration, in the absence of a AUMF. And they were authorized on the basis of self-defense and imminence. And if you look at the imminence of those threats, they were not temporally imminent, right? And so this is when I said this problem isn't new. It's not new in counterterrorism. I think the U.S. view of imminence, and Ken knows this history better than I do, so correct me if I'm wrong, Ken. I mean, it really, the public articulation of U.S. views of imminence date back at least to the Reagan administration and to Abe Sofer and George Shultz, whom, you know, you'll hear from Abe later today. But that was the position of the State Department Legal Advisor's Office in the Reagan administration. So,
But with respect to what threats at that point?
I think they were thinking principally about Hezbollah. The problem that gives rise to it, right, is the same problem, which is, okay, you're not dealing with a group of people that's going to amass an army along a front, and you can say, well, okay, at this point the threat reaches this level of imminence. For you're dealing with something that may happen at any time, and you just kind of don't know how soon, how certain. And so you define imminence in a less temporally bound, somewhat more diffuse way. It was controversial then. It's controversial now. I don't know what you do about that. except either live with the disquiet, which is what we do, or not engage in a whole lot of kinetic activity that you might otherwise want to engage in.
Carrie.
Two questions. First, in terms of targeting and the definition of feasible, I'm just thinking in my own mind if things had gone south in Somalia a few weeks ago with the attempted capture of someone there, whether the definition of feasible would have been blown up. And the second is, one of the most interesting parts of your first chapter with Ken was what the administration has not been talking about in
right.
terms of indefinite detention. So,
well, okay, so on feasibility, I think it's a genuine open question what we're going to come to understand feasible as meaning. And you can read the last couple months, or 4 months since May in different directions. One, as Mark and Scott both, as Greg and Scott both pointed out, is that there were these flurry of strikes that didn't seem that imminent relative to prior strikes. Another way is to say, hey, we just did two capture operations, right? And we did two capture operations, one successful, one unsuccessful, of a type that we kind of hadn't been doing that much of, Warsami accepted, over the last few years. And maybe that's because there was a judgment, hey, capture is feasible here, therefore it's required under the new policy. So I think you can kind of, I'm going to actually just wait till more data is in on that question, because I really don't know. But I do think you can say the following about feasibility of capture. One is that feasibility, the human rights groups sometimes talk about feasibility as synonymous with, doability, right? Could you get it done? And I think it's quite clear that the U.S. government does not understand it that way, but rather understands it as, something less, right? The second thing is that in a way that I think a human rights group never would tolerate, one of the factors that the government is going to think of when it thinks about feasibility is bilateral damage to the relationship with the host government. And so, there are these situations where you ask a question, is it tactically feasible to, capture Ben Wittes in this location? And the answer is, yeah, you could insert troops and get it done. But if you ask the question, is it feasible without, creating a huge blow up in the relationship with Pakistan to put boots on the ground there, the answer is, boy, that would be awful, right? And so the question of what factors you're including in your feasibility analysis, as well as to what extent does feasible on the one hand mean possible to get done and on the other hand mean convenient, if that's the spectrum, I'm quite confident that the bilateral relationship issue figures prominently in their feasibility analysis. And I'm really not sure I understand what the word feasible means on the spectrum I just described. But I think those are sort of two places where the administration is probably clearly thinking differently than, say, a human rights group when they hear the word feasible.
Quickly, isn't feasibility also a matter of the casualties we're willing to incur, not civilian casualties? And is there any body of law or recent literature thinking that outlines how you might, it seems like a very vague
Look,
line before ma- you draw.
Many operations are feasible if you're willing to incur a lot of casualties and are not feasible if you're not willing to incur any, right? And so, again, how you evaluate feasibility with reference to force protection and how you evaluate it with reference to civilian protection are going to affect your judgment of what that word means. This is why, I think you could imagine this policy shift, as some of the evidence that we've seen suggests, meaning very little. We will still do drone strikes. We'll do a little bit fewer of them. because we understand feasibility in a very narrow sense, right? And one of the other possibility is that, you know, this operates as a very real constraint because you take that word very seriously. I think the data is just up in the air on that. But yes, force protection is a huge, perhaps the dominant component of whatever feasibility analysis you're going to do.
Quick add, could you have an inverse relation between these two terms you're using? I mean, if a threat is regarded as increasingly imminent, is it less feasible under those circumstances to go in with a capture?
Yes, I think that's exactly right. I think the more temporal you regard imminence, the imminence of a particular situation, the more narrowly you are likely to read the word feasible. And the more you consider it imminent in the sense of, you know, nothing's going to happen. We don't know that anything's going to happen right now. There's maybe not an unfolding plot, but this person provides a continuing and therefore ongoing and ever imminent threat. The more you may have the luxury of planning an operation, and the more feasible capture may be.
I want to ask you two questions. One is about the Cairo speech in 2009. And the other is about, if you look at the trajectory of all these speeches, would you say that you think they make a pattern of the president seeking to constrain his own and future president's powers? Or would you say that that's the sort of cover for what they're really trying to do, which is to bolster their authority to do stuff in perpetuity? Do you see any effort for him to be trying to constrain foreign leaders from taking the same action while preserving his own ability to do it?
So this is a very deep question, and it actually interacts in interesting ways with Scott's question of how seriously you should take these speeches and whether you should understand them as serious articulations of law or more frivolous exercises in politics, or both. So they are doing both. At the macro level, the Obama administration has claimed a lot more authority than people expected it to claim. I think that's fair to say. Some people are miserable at that. I'm not. I thought that my enthusiasm for the Bush administration was always under control. My enthusiasm for the Obama administration has always been under control as well. I think that there's certain powers that the president of whatever party needs to claim in order to do the things that we expect him or her to do. And I have not been sorry to see the Obama administration, despite its own predilections in important respects and the president's own predilections in certain respects, come to the realization that it needs those authorities. That said, I do think it is a mistake, and it's a pretty common one, to overlook the quite real self-imposed constraints that the administration has adopted. And so the most obvious one in the area that we're talking about is the difference between at-will targeting and the sort of targeting that they're doing, admittedly as a policy matter, right? Not as, you know, their view of the law is that they can target they can target the enemy with lethal force.
Loose definition.
Although that gets into a different subject, but broadly speaking, their legal views are quite permissive, and their policy views are dramatically more restrictive. We've been talking about how much more restrictive or how much less, but they're certainly not arguing that they can target or that they will target under policy everybody they regard as al-Qaeda in lots of places in the world. So the question is, do you take that as a feint, as an insignificant, sort of political constraint? Or do you take it as something that creates a very strong norm toward which other presidents will likely gravitate? And to the extent that you then over time narrow the scope of the legal conflict if they actually succeed in doing that, that does have a way of forcing what is now policy into law. So I think there's an element of both going on. I also think that the efforts, and you see this most visibly with respect to, the effort to think through at a very, at a sort of deep level, you really see this in some of the Al-Alawi stuff, what the legal constraints really are, I think is not insincere. And so I think there's an element of both. You know, at the end of the day, they claim a lot of power and they're anxious about it. And the Bush administration claimed a lot of power and was sometimes a lot less anxious about it. And I think it is worth, A, keeping in mind that a lot of the same powers are claimed and that the differences in practice are not that vast, and in some cases entirely farcical. But it's also worth keeping in mind that the self-image here is not entirely delusional, and that there has been a lot of very serious thought, including leading up to the May 23rd speech, about the relationship between policy and law and constraint. And those are, I think it's a mistake to be entirely dismissive of that.
I don't want to take too much time because I know other people have questions, but what I wanted to ask you about Cairo in 09 is...
Can I ask a quick question to follow on you? Have you noticed a difference between their first term speeches and this second term in terms of how they're boxing themselves in or giving themselves flexibility?
That's an easy one. The NDU speech is dramatically different in tone from the first term speeches, so much so that Ken and I had to rewrite chapters 1 and 2 to bracket them to be about the first term, and we had to add an entirely separate chapter about the May speech. There was only one brief discussion in all of the first term speeches of the end of the conflict, and that was in Jay Johnson's speech at the Oxford Union. The end of the conflict is the subject of the May 23rd speech, and it reflects a very different sensibility about how the administration is thinking about its authorities. It's thinking about to what extent it can and should wind them down. And in the first term, it was thinking about how to defend them and how to explain what they were doing. And I think those are, deeply different.
Walter.
Oh, no.
Sorry, Margaret had a second part.
My question was basically, at the risk of being facetious, like, what was that? Did they mean it for a second and then they didn't mean it anymore?
That's a question really better directed to my wife than to me. This was really a speech about, relationship with the Middle East and the Muslim world. And that's kind of, broadly speaking, related to but not the subject that Ken and I were working on.
Do that and then do what they've done with drones and...
I have no doubt that there is a grave tension between one set of speeches and the other, but we've been trying to work on the speeches about the legal authorities, not the speeches about how people should love us.
Spencer, you have something to add?
Yeah, I'm wondering then, in that light, why we shouldn't understand these speeches as speeches about policy rather than speeches about, speeches more about policy sort of masquerading as law when we've got essentially the legally relevant language on the precipice of absurdity, whether it's imminence, whether it's feasibility, and I would suggest also in the context of signature strikes targeted. Shouldn't we just understand this is the administration isn't articulating a series of statements about, as we typically understand law, to be about authorities and constraints. They're talking about things they won't do rather than things they have determined they can't do.
Sometimes. So if you read the speeches carefully, and we've tried to flag all of these points, sometimes they refer to what they regard the law as requiring, and sometimes they refer to what they adopt as policy. And so this is where the interagency process is really valuable, because there are these lawyers in the different agencies who make sure that whenever somebody's going to say something that's not their legal position, but that's only their policy position, these lawyers will make sure to write in, you know, as a matter of policy, comma, right? And so the speeches are actually pretty careful about distinguishing between law and policy. Many readers of the speeches are not. And you can get a very good sense from them of what the administration regards as legal boundaries and what they regard as self-imposed policy constraints.
Even when the legally relevant language is stretched to a point where we find ourselves debating really in a context of policy, what they will do rather than what they feel that they can and cannot do.
So, but that reflects in turn. So you're right. You're absolutely right that there are a series of issues, and you've identified three of them, where you have a legal policy question concerning what certain legally binding terms mean and require, and that those are whether you see those as law or see those as policy is, an angel's on the head of a pin kind of question. They merge at that point. On the other hand, those are the same terms if you got the underlying memos. Those are the same terms that are being discussed in those memos. And so those are the pivot points on which these decisions are being made, both as a matter of law and as a matter of policy. The speeches are the windows that we have into that.
Jamie? It strikes me that high-level targets would either be never imminent or always imminent, because they're always planning and plotting. Therefore, they would never lose their imminence. But if they're not always imminent, then it would only be low-level targets that would potentially be imminent. Looking at the Yemen case with Awlaki and the underwear bomber, if Awlaki is only imminent at certain points, then it would strike me as he's never imminent, because he's never going to actually attack in the sense that he is going to try to get on a plane and come to the homeland. The only person there who is imminent would be the underwear bomber in a small time frame. But if he is actually under the definition of imminent at some point, isn't he always imminent? Because he's always planning and plotting some plot somewhere against the United States.
So I think the answer to that is with respect to a certain category of high-level operational leader, their attitude is that this person poses an imminent threat in general, which is why they sometimes use the phrase continuing and imminent, and that any time the opportunity to strike, you know, once you've crossed that threshold in importance and, it's a dubious honor of some sort, right? Once you cross that threshold, the question is an opportunistic question, not a do you meet it at this moment question. And by the way, this is an area where the never the twain shall meet between the administration and the human rights community. So in Amnesty's report the other day, they took the administration to task for having hit a different al-Libi, who was a senior al-Qaeda figure who was killed in a drone strike in Pakistan. And the reason that they were anxious about this killing as possibly illegal is that at the time of the strike, he was engaged in rescue activity with respect to a prior survivors of a prior drone strike. And the report, which, raises legal questions about this, both on grounds that he was involved in rescue activity, but also on grounds that he was not at the time directly participating in hostilities. And therefore, they don't say it this way, but it goes to your point. If he's not directly participating in hostilities at the time that you hit him, is he a lawful target? The administration has a very different view of that, and that is really once you cross a certain threshold, you're fair game.
Fred, did you have something to add to that or something new?
I wanted to add to what Ben was saying about do we need a new policy or a new, and it goes back to your three stages from AUMF to self-defense. I mean, if that's not an accurate description of the real world, if in fact the United States is still in a conflict, but that's a conflict decreasingly described by AUMF, what are the policy and legal implications either for this or the next president?
Well, so this goes back to an earlier question about the mismatch between our reality and the international law terms that we use to describe these things. And, you know, look, the AUMF is a wildly outdated document. And you read it, and it does not describe any of the stuff that we're doing, except in the sense in which you can build emanations from it to a modern reality. I think it is a bad thing to continue to rely on such a document. We have a Congress that can't pass a budget, you know, and it actually, you know, can't do the easy stuff of running a day-to-day government, or of, you know, it's part of a day-to-day government. This is a really hard question, right? How do you authorize the conflict, that part of the conflict that we're fighting that you actually want to continue fighting? How do you define it? How much do you delegate those judgments to the executive branch? How much do you write them yourselves? So when Matt and Ken and Matt and Bobby and Jack and I tried to write our paper trying to do this, we all are basically operating in the same worldview. And it was really hard. And a lot of people think we didn't do a very good job, you know. So even within our relatively constrained group of people who have basically a very similar worldview, getting to what the prospective authorization looks like is a really, really difficult set of questions. And I didn't, you know, and people by and large did not respond to that by saying, ah, yes, they've done the work. Now let's just implement it, right? That was not the response to that. And so I think there's a, you know, I could tell you what I think. In fact, we have written what we think the sort of Platonic ideal, the best we can do in that direction. I don't think there's any prospect of Congress taking that on except in a crisis. And when it takes it on in a crisis, I can promise you that it will do something much more elastic and less restrictive than what we described in that paper. I don't know what else to tell you on that point. I mean, I think until that happens, you're really operating in a world in which Congress refuses to give guidance, and the executive has to balance domestic constitutional law constraints, the waning of the AUMF, international law constraints, its own anxieties, and arising new threats, the magnitude of which it often is not entirely sure. And it's going to do that internally through a combination of a sense of law and, as Spencer points out, the bleeding of that into policy considerations. And I wish there were some, you know, magic good government answer to that problem. But I think the reality is that a Congress that can't bother to, you know, it can't focus on the issue. And to the extent that it can, there's simply no agreement as to what the right legislative outcome would look like. And by the way, one other point on this, the president doesn't know what he wants on this. So in this speech, and this is, you know, in the May 23rd speech, he aggressively defends everything he's done under the AUMF. Calls for a repeal or restriction of the AUMF, chastises those of us who want the AUMF in some form extended and rewritten, you know, wags his finger at the public about the continuation of detentions under the AUMF, all of which he has defended in federal court, promises to end all those detentions and offers no strategy for doing so. So, you know, even within the person of the president, there is inadequate agreement to support a kind of legislative, and I think that, you know, that goes to Mark's question: is it corrosive of government, of our government, that that's the state we're in? Yeah, it is. I don't really know what to do about it.
Thank you for listening to the Lawfare podcast, produced in collaboration with the Brookings Institution. Our music was performed by Sophia Yan.
Ever Googled your own name? Prepare for a shock because your personal info, including addresses and phone numbers, is out there, especially with the recent hacks at some big phone and healthcare companies. But here's where Aura steps in. Aura scans the dark web for your sensitive information and sends real-time alerts. Aura also actively requests that your information be removed from data broker sites, putting you back in control. Aura provides you with a complete online safety toolkit, credit and transaction monitoring, a secure password manager, a privacy-enhancing VPN, and more. Try Aura risk-free with a 14-day trial at aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety. Rest easy with Aura. Visit aura.com/safety today.